there that are just anticipating your argument.
Oh, well, good. It's a pleasure to be here. Good afternoon. And I'm happy to be here representing my client, Columbus Moore. I'd like to start off, Your Honors, with a brief summation of the facts, and then if we need to, we can go back to the facts later to explain particular issues. On September 2008, State Police Trooper Chad Grimion initiated an investigation on peer-to-peer networks within the Central Louisiana area. Now, a peer-to-peer network, in this case, LimeWire, is a program that allows one person's personal computer to interact with another person's personal computer on a direct basis and share files. And I'll go into that more a little bit later when we discuss the expert testimony. But the state police had developed a program that...
Now, let me make sure that I understand. This peer-to-peer network...
Yes, sir.
...can be totally intrastate.
It could
possibly be totally interstate.
Yes, sir.
Or some combination.
Yes, sir. And
okay. Isn't that enough?
And there's...
Isn't that enough to establish interstate commerce in this case?
Well, Judge, in this case...
In other words, you don't have to prove necessarily that the shared information came, where it came from necessarily, but that the vehicle by which it was shared is a vehicle in interstate commerce. That is to say, this peer-to-peer network.
Well, no, sir. During the old language that the government used in this case, what you have to prove is that it had been mailed, shipped, and transported in interstate and foreign commerce by any means, including a computer.
Including a what?
Including a computer.
Okay, computer, sure.
Okay. And what the government did not prove in this case, which is that there any evidence that any of the materials came from an out-of-state source.
But do you have to prove that? That's my point. In other words, telephone lines.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up.
Or telegraph lines.
Mm-hmm. Well, in other cases, for example, in wire fraud cases, the government has the Congress has passed different laws concerning the jurisdiction of the court, and sometimes it passes a broad jurisdictional nexus, and sometimes it's a limited one.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in this case, the law now has changed from a limited jurisdictional element to a broad one, partly because of United States versus Shaver and the argument I'm about to make. At the close of evidence, I made a Rule 29 motion saying that the government had not proved Element 3 beyond a reasonable doubt that there was that the materials in question had moved from state to state. Now, in the indictment, as I've read, it is a law that has currently been changed. So now if I brought this argument now, it would fail because now the language is that had been mailed or using any means or facility of interstate commerce. And the Congress changed the language in these statutes back at the end of 2008. Our foreign commerce shipped or transported in or affecting interstate or foreign commerce by any means, including a computer.
Now, does that cut in favor of you or against you?
Well,
are they trying to clarify the statute or have they changed it radically?
Well, I think, Your Honor, that they understood that under the old language that the government would have to prove that the images traveled in interstate commerce, whereas with the new language, all they have to prove is that it was transported and affected interstate commerce or an instrumentality that affects interstate commerce.
Now, you're talking about 2252A.
Yes, sir, as it stands now versus how it stood before the amendment, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm.
And to give you an example of that, in United States versus Cora, which is a Ninth Circuit case, but I cite it for persuasive value, it reversed a conviction under federal extortion statute for transmitting in interstate commerce any communication containing a threat where the government failed to prove that a threatening telephone communication was actually transmitted across state lines.
But we've never held that in our circuit, I believe.
Well, the government relies on.
I mean, am I correct that we have never held that to be the requirement?
No, sir. But I'd like to distinguish the cases in this circuit from the case of Barr factually.
Okay.
The government relies on two cases, United States versus Runson and United States versus Vinson. And the distinguishing factors in United States versus Runyon, which was a case where a husband and wife had got divorced, and the government came in and found pictures of an underage a minor, and they identified the minor, and there was testimony that the defendant had and intended to sell these pictures to out of foreign sources, mm-hmm. out of state and out of the nation. And what's different about the facts in this case is that the government in Runyon had an independent nexus other than simply that the images came from the internet. That, first off, the statements to Misty indicated that he trafficked internationally in child pornography, and also that some of the images had the actual website address where he had gotten the images from. So there was a separate factual nexus that showed that he intended and he trafficked internationally in pornography and that some of the images came from.
What you're saying is that this statute, as it was written before the amendment, required the government to show that the image itself was transported in interstate commerce.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
And another and probably the most important factual difference between Runyon and the case at Barr, sir, is that the Nutella protocol, which allows this peer-to-peer network to exist, was not in existence at the time Runyon was decided, or the time that the defendant Runyon committed the crime. The Nutella protocol is a protocol that allows one person's personal computer to speak and share files with another person's personal computer without going to a central server or without without anything between the two. It's similar.
Why is the central server so important in your argument?
Well,
I mean, if it can transmit, if the government proved that the images came from a computer, some other computer.
Yes, sir.
Why, in your opinion, does the central server become so important in your argument?
Well, it's not as important, but the reason is they were always usually able to show that the central server existed in some other state or some other nation. And in this case, there's uncontroverted expert testimony that it's possible for all these communications to happen within the state.
Now, I mean, you would agree that if these images were transmitted from one computer in Louisiana to, or say Texas, to a computer in Louisiana, that the interstate nexus has been proved?
Yes, sir.
Okay. And by definition, this peer-to-peer network does not disclose that. Is that correct?
Well, that's not necessarily the case. All I'm aware of in this case is that the government didn't show any of that at trial. They've identified most of these pictures. They could have put on evidence of the original source of the pictures, or they could have identified the IP addresses, which is almost a street address that identifies a certain computer, mm-hmm. that's where these images came from. It certainly would have been possible and probably easy for the government to prove these things. They didn't. So my argument is that in the complete absence of any evidence at all, other than that these images came from the internet, that there cannot have proven that element beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, they also rely on United States versus Vinson. And in that case, there was also an independent nexus that these images traveled across state lines. It was a sting operation set up by Dallas PD where a person in Louisiana ordered videos from him, and the videos were actually sent from Dallas and delivered here in New Orleans. Also, if I can grab that case. Also, these images included a well-known series of child pornography that originated in Texas. And so they knew about the images, they knew where they came from, and they put on testimony as to where these images came from.
So they knew the origin, and obviously they took the computer from another state, and then, ergo, they proved whatever they had to prove.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Now, in this case, there's no independent nexus. And if we can go to our expert testimony, testified that, if I could, that you wouldn't know necessarily whether a file was coming from a computer in Pineville or whether it was coming for a computer in Afghanistan. And there wasn't really any discrepancy or argument between the experts in this case. The government simply showed that the images came from the internet, and our experts simply showed that given the unique nature of this Nutella protocol.
So what you're really saying is that if it's a peer-to-peer network, prosecution of a peer-to-peer network distribution scheme, there's no way in heck you can prove that you can prove.
Well,
you can. Well, I mean, the experts supposedly said they would not know where these images came from, right?
Yeah, in this particular case, not in every case, simply because they didn't put on evidence of that.
Okay.
Your Honor. And I think it'd be easy to prove otherwise. And I think that Congress is, when it passed the limited jurisdictional aspect of this crime, that they envisioned that this statute would be used for prosecution of people that were bigger fish than just people doing it inside the state. And it's a court of limited jurisdiction. Of course, Congress changed their mind and then broadened the language in the statute.
Mr. Beck, you've got about 2:30 left. Talk about the testimony of the daughter, or the stepdaughter.
Okay.
The 403 issue, I guess it is.
Yes, sir.
Were you trial counsel?
Sir?
Did you try the case?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
It's my first federal trial. It's my first federal appeal.
Okay.
You're doing a very good job, so keep on going.
Thank you, Judge. I filed a motion in limine to exclude uncharged evidence. And the government wanted to introduce this evidence under Article 414, which says that
Rule 414.
Sir?
You mean Rule 414?
Yes, Federal Rule of Evidence 414 that allows evidence of child molestation in.
You better hurry up. Just 414. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. And you're familiar with what it says. I won't read it to the court right now. And I made two arguments against that. Number one, that the conduct that they sought to introduce did not constitute an offense of child molestation. And number two, that it should be excluded pursuant to the balancing test in 403.
Well, let's talk on the first one. It seems to me that when you approach a child's bedroom and there's the conduct that's alleged here, or the evidence seems to indicate that comes into the terminology child molestation.
Well, Judge, the testimony that it was actually perfected at trial didn't show that. The only thing that they put on at trial, and they had a journal that they talked a lot about before trial, and they had interviews with the child that they did not introduce. The only thing that was introduced to the child was the child's testimony. And
let me cut you off.
Yes, sir.
Let me ask you a quick question. I take it that in the opening statement or at some point the prosecutor had indicated to the jury about this testimony was what was actually going to come from the child.
Yes, sir.
At the time she was put on the stand, you know, she's got the blanket, but she does not say what had been represented that she would say. Correct?
Yes, sir.
All right. So you had filed a motion in limine. So you got a ruling against you in the motion in limine, right?
Yes, sir.
All right. So at the time that they called the witness, or immediately after, did you renew an objection to that testimony? I mean, I know you had filed lost yes. on the motion to limit.
I did not renew the objection.
Yet. Okay.
I believe my time's up.
Okay. You don't want to say any more?
But I do, yes.
Okay. Since we asked a lot of questions, you got about another minute.
Okay, thank you, Judge. And that when the testimony came, all she testified to was the touching of her buttocks over her clothes and didn't put it in any context to where the touching could have been of a lascivious nature. Now, I put on testimony from
her. There is no testimony that it occurred in her bedroom late at night.
There might have been that, Your Honor, but
You don't think that's enough?
Well, Your Honor, the touching of a child's buttocks over their clothes, I have a kid.
In bed, late at night, in her room.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Now, because the evidence didn't show what it was supposed to show, in order to pass the Ballington test, you're weighing the probative value versus the prejudice to the defendant. Now, in this case, because there wasn't any probative testimony that actually alleged child molestation, I believe that the prejudicial effect to the defendant clearly outweighed the probative value.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Judge.
Ms. Kessier.
Good afternoon, Your Honors.
Good afternoon.
I think I will pick up where he left off with that second argument with regard to the testimony. The child, the AUSA in his opening statement, for one thing, the opening statement is not in the record. That was not transcribed. But you can tell from some later statements after the child's testimony when the AUSA withdrew the journal entry that the child had made. The AUSA withdrew that from evidence and was able to do so because there's the statement that he had not made reference in great detail to what the child would testify about. And she did testify, apparently, within the parameters of what the AUSA had said in his opening statement, and there's no other comment with regard to she did not testify as much as he said she would.
Was the judge's limiting instruction tailored further? I'm sure from experience he had a limiting instruction he was going to give just based on knowing that this was going to come up. So once, you know, the testimony doesn't occur the way it was represented, did he further tailor the limiting instruction to the jury vis-a-vis what the jury could?
His instruction was very clear, and it was lengthy, and he just made it quite clear to the attorneys what his instruction was going to be. There was no objection by the defense to the instruction, nor was there a request for any additional instruction on the child's testimony. And the child did testify that he entered her bedroom, that he touched her buttocks over her clothing on numerous occasions, she just could not testify to the other things that had come out in the detention hearing and that she had written in her journal. They could not get her to say any of that.
I've looked at this. I mean, I'm familiar with 404B. I wasn't as familiar with 414, so I kind of got intrigued by it, on the purpose of it being passed, I only found one case. I found a Sixth Circuit case, U.S. versus Huff, H-O-U-G-H, in which the district judge had excluded the same kind of evidence, and the government appealed, and the Sixth Circuit affirmed the district court's exclusion, you know, of the testimony, same situation we're talking about here, on the 414. But again, it was a case of the district court had excluded and the Sixth Circuit affirmed the exclusion. I mean, it's the same balance that, you know, we know time immemorial going
exactly
through. So I guess all that to say it's a real judgment call, as typically these evidentiary matters tend to be. I'm not sure in reading this case if the judge had let it in, whether they would have reversed him, you know,
because. Well, Your Honor, the government gave notice that this testimony was going to be presented at trial. The defendant filed a motion in limine to have it excluded. The district judge, there were some pretty lengthy memos filed on this issue, and the judge made a written ruling that is very detailed, explaining that essentially the reason for it was because defendant had raised the defense, or there was the likelihood that he was raising the defense that, number one, he did not know about the child pornography and had not downloaded the child pornography on there, and that someone else had done it.
There's no doubt, at least not in my mind, there's no doubt that it's relevant.
So
there's no doubt in my mind that, I mean, even if it was under 404, to me, you know, would be come in as relevant. It's the second piece that we always deal with these kind of matters in tilting that balance about prejudice, not whether it's relevant, that part.
Right.
It's the second piece of it in terms of the, you know, 9 times out of 10, we never say it's more prejudicial. I mean, the whole point of putting it in is because it's prejudicial.
Right.
The question is whether it's inflammatory. So taking it into context, I'm trying to visualize, you know, a child coming in, the transcript, you know, she's got the blanket, da-da-da, and it's kind of like less what she did or didn't say, whether she said everything that was in the diary entries or not. But, you know, once the representation was made to the jury, you know, to some extent it's the old skunk in the jury box, you know, kind of argument there. I mean, it's dicey, that's all I'm saying. When I found a case where it had in fact been excluded, I didn't find a lot of cases under 414, period.
Right. The judge did make that balancing, and it is in his written ruling, and it is very detailed, and it
so
is.
So we have plain error review? I mean, it's raised in the motion in limine. I'm not sure how Judge Drell does. I don't know whether he would have made defense counsel, you know, maintain the objection again, given that it was raised earlier. So do you take the position that because it was raised in the motion in limine, you know, it was part of the trial, it's alive, you know, before us on a straight up, you know, ruling, or that
abuse
only
of discretion.
Raised? All right. So you don't take the position that this is plain error?
No, Your Honor. It was contested all the way through,
okay.
And so it would be abuse of discretion.
Okay. I just want to be clear, you know, on that point. Okay.
Correct. Now, back to the jurisdictional aspect of the offense. I think the Fifth Circuit has had it right all along. Some of the other circuits have had to monkey around with things. The Fifth Circuit has said that, I believe it's the Fourth Circuit that they adopted the opinion, and that is that the use of the Internet is tantamount to interstate commerce, and the government must provide evidence that links the specific images to the Internet, and the government did that in this case.
Now, how about the amendment and the effect of that amendment? Was that what's your argument that it clarified prior law as opposed to changing prior law?
I believe it clarified it, Your Honor, because the whole business of Internet use and child pornography has been an explosion, and Congress is trying to keep up with technological advances as they are made.
I understand all of that, but is there some congressional history that indicates that it was a clarification as opposed to a change in the law?
Your Honor,
wholesale change.
I do not have any legislative history on the changes.
We're all speculating whether it is or not.
I would say one thing by analogy and by comparison, the definition of visual depiction in 2256, I think it's 4, has been amended numerous times since I believe about 1989 or 1990. And every time it has been because of some technological advance that has come up in a trial and a court has had to deal with it, and Congress has either reacted to it or affirmed what the court did with that. And in most instances, the courts have found that it covered it because Congress intended to paint with a broad brush when it dealt with child pornography and its jurisdictional aspect of covering child pornography and proscribing it in every form. And that's just one instance that I know of, that there are several cases on that, and you can directly trace them to the a court decision. So I would say that that supports to some extent that Congress is continually clarifying. With respect to the peer-to-peer and the LimeWire, there is a great deal of testimony by...
What's the difference between peer-to-peer and LimeWire?
Well, the peer-to-peer appears to be, it's the Nutella, it's a particular protocol. And LimeWire is a program that uses that protocol. And I'm no computer guru, so I cannot really explain that, but that's what Grémillon explained in his testimony, the difference between the protocol and the program. There are several programs that use the peer-to-peer or the Nutella protocol. And they mentioned BearShare as one, and then LimeWire as another. But all of these programs have to have the internet. The individual has to be logged onto the internet. And what Grémillon explained, he presented a PowerPoint explanation to the jury and to the court of how these peer-to-peer programs work. And in that, he showed how a person could put in a search. And he had put in a search. It happened to be LSU Tigers. He put that search in. And it connects to everybody else who has a LimeWire share folder. It will go into all of those folders, not just nationwide, worldwide, and any match to that shows up. And then the defendant or the person who has plugged in that search can then choose which of these he wants. It is not clear whether he knows they are from where their source is, but they are all from the internet.
You're suggesting that any search, including the, I presume there was a search here, is that what you're saying?
There must have been. I don't know what the specific search was. I don't recall that came up.
If there was, that search would clearly, in all occasions, cross interstate lines.
It would come.
Whether or not it was successful in mating with a particular response
Right, because there are LimeWire subscribers, I would suppose, worldwide, certainly nationwide. It is something that is known. So the use of the internet is required, and then once you get into the LimeWire program, as I understand it, then you plug in this search, and it goes over everybody who is a member.
Well, it's got to be in the record, and if it's not in the record, it's just not in the record.
Right, Your Honor. And Grémillon did testify in great detail to that. Defendant's expert did not really punch any holes in Grémillon's testimony. He distinguished between the protocol and the program, and he did admit that some of the files in the LimeWire, he said at least some of them, had been obtained off the internet. Grémillon's testimony was that there were 25 child porn movies. All of them were obtained through the LimeWire, and they were all in a defendant's shared folder of LimeWire, which means that they could have gone to anybody else whose search hit upon those particular folders. Is there any other question regarding this?
Nope.
Then I will submit it on the record. Thank you.
Mr. Beck, anything else?
Yeah, rebuttal.
Okay.
Start off where she left off. There's nothing at all in the record about if there were searches. There's nothing at all in the record about if there were searches, where these searches went.
Well, the question is, it seems to me, is there in the record that in order to obtain an image, you have to search for one through this LimeWire program?
Yes, there is. But the simply searching for an image is not the same as downloading an image. The search simply gives you a list of things that you can download.
That's right. But it it has to get that information from those shared folders, right?
Yes, it gets that information.
So there is some communication between all these shared folders, and then you just go through the list and you decide what you're going to download.
But in order to physically transport that image from one computer to another, you don't get to preview the image. There's simply a written description of what the image may or may not contain.
But that information has got to come from someplace.
Mm-hmm. But there's no evidence in the record of where that place is.
Yep.
You know, I think I'm arguing a very important principle of law, and that is if the government wants to prove something, we don't need to suppose that it happened, that it needs to be proved. Now, the Tenth Circuit, United States versus Schaefer, took this issue head on, although it wasn't concerning the Nutella protocol, and it ruled that the complete absence of proof at trial that the images possessed and received traveled across state lines requires an acquittal, as the jurisdictional nexus is an essential element of the statute. Now, as a result of this ruling, Congress went back and broadened the jurisdictional requirement. So any case that comes up today, this argument cannot be made. It's a very limited argument. Now, if I could go back to the testimony concerning the 414 evidence, I think that the court should be very careful with 414 evidence, because it's made an exception in 404 that allows extrinsic uncharged conduct to come in and be used against a defendant. And this type of evidence, there's a long history of the court's understanding that this evidence can be highly prejudicial. The United States Supreme Court has, you know, consistently ruled that this type of evidence it needs to be handled with great care. And that's why the requirement in 403 is so important. And I think that the Third Circuit put it very good in Johnson versus Elk Lake School District, where a past act cannot be shown with reasonable certainty, its probative value is reduced, and it may prejudice the defendant unfairly, confuse the issues, mislead the jury, and result in undue delay and waste of time. All reasons for excluding the evidence. Now, in this case, the government overstated its hand on how well it could prove that the alleged past conduct could occur. Now, in my brief against the government, I argued that this conduct did not occur. I had a witness at trial, the minor school teacher, that testified that she had falsely accused another classmate about sexual things, and that when the teacher reported the incident to her, she said it was a dream and not an actual occurrence. And so there was, and if we look at her sealed testimony, there's some confusion as to whether she dreamed this up or it actually happened. And I think because that the government could not show that this act happened with any reasonable certainty, its probative value is very much reduced, and the prejudicial effect of that evidence should outweigh the concerns in 414.
Mr. Beck, thank you very much.
Thank you, Judge.
Ms. Castillo, thank you. We have your case under submission. The court will be